This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jeff Gordon has spent almost his entire life in racing. And if you don't believe that, consider this. He began competing and winning races at 5. He wasn't yet in kindergarten, and already he was strapped into a car that reached 50 miles an hour. That taste of speed and competition must have morphed into an unquenchable thirst matched only by the kind of skill behind the wheel that would make him a racing star and a household name. Jeff Gordon officially retired in 2015, but when you look at his life today, away from the storied number 24 car, he's anything but retired. He's stepped into the broadcast booth as a race analyst for Fox Sports. He's been filling in for Dale Earnhardt Jr. on the track. His work with the Jeff Gordon Children's Foundation, which has raised millions for pediatric cancer research, continues to grow. And at the end of January, he'll be back on the track to start, I can't believe I'm going to say this, his rookie season in the IMSA Sports Car Championship Series in the Rolex 24. But somehow he found a way to carve an hour out of his schedule to talk to us. And Jeff Gordon joins us for the hour from the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Great to be on the show.
So I was reading the book that has been written about you. I think it's recently released or just out now.
Yeah, just last November.
Jeff Gordon, His Dream, Drive, and Destiny. I was reading this and it was talking about how at 5 you were BMX racing and then you went on to some kind of car racing. And I thought, you know, at 5, I couldn't even ride a bike. How did you do that?
Well, I grew up in Vallejo, California. I lived on a hill. There's just, you know, in our neighborhood, all the kids in the neighborhood that were older than me got on their bicycles. They went to the top of this hill and rode their bikes down the hill. And at a young age, I wanted to learn how to ride a bicycle. So at 3, 3 and a half, I started riding a bicycle. And by 4, I'm riding down this hill. And then I found out there was a BMX bicycle track just up the street, about 2 miles away from our racetrack, from our home, and started going there and racing BMX around 4 and a half. And my mom saw what was going on and saw some kids get hurt and told my stepfather, yeah, that's maybe not a good idea. I don't know if BMX bicycle racing is really right for him. And maybe that was a part of the master plan of my stepfather because he loved cars. But the next thing I know, around 5, he's bringing home a quarter midget, which was this small race car for young kids to get behind the wheel. One for me, one for my sister. I have a 4-year older sister. And the rest is kind of history. We went to the fairgrounds in Vallejo and threw rocks around and did donuts in this parking lot. And next thing I know, I'm going to the racetrack and, you know, seeing the green flag and not long after that, a checkered flag. And that's when it was in my blood.
Let's go back. You're the first bike, I think, if this is right, the first bike you had, your father gave you, and he dropped it off at the house. It was an old junker bike. And your stepfather said, you need to learn to, I'm going to work, you need to ride this, you need to learn to ride this without the training wheels.
That's true.
By the time I get home. And if you don't, I'm throwing it in the junk heap.
Well, I think this right here starts to paint the picture of where the motivation in my life came from and what pushed me along the way. I mean, I think he balanced it out well, but there were times where he was harsh, and that was one of them. And I remember by the time he got home, I was riding that bike without training wheels. Of course, I had a fat lip to go along with it, because I went up the one of the curbs on our sidewalk and just face planted, and so I had a little bit of a scar to go along with it. But I didn't complain. I rode the bike, and you know, when he saw that, immediately the wheel started turning in his head of, okay, now we need to get a proper bicycle for him to go race with.
So now it's you were born in 1971. And by 19, is that right?
Yes.
And by 1976, you'd won the BMX state championship. So that you were 5 years old. And to me, that's fairly amazing. I mean, at 5, you're racing against what, guys who are 7, 8?
Yeah.
You had very short legs, I think, in comparison to those guys.
This story may have been told by my stepfather. My I love him, but he embellishes just slightly. So I don't know if I'd call it a state championship, maybe a local championship. But I did okay. I mean, you know, if there were six kids and two of the fast ones fell, I'd win the race.
So, I was going to ask you, where did the competitive spirit come from? But it sounds like it wasn't necessarily competitive. It
was the effort was there. There was certainly plenty of effort and drive and passion. But at that time, I think the physicality of it. And there was another moment like that later. I was already racing, but I was in junior high. And we started doing these different sports during, you know, PE. And I found out there was a competition for pull-ups and push-ups and throwing softballs and baseballs and things. And so I told, you know, my mom and my dad, I said, I want to go do this. I want to compete in this. I've been doing this at school. I think I've got some skills. And so on a weekend that I happen to not be racing, I get my sweatsuit on and I go to the school, and all these kids show up from around Vallejo in that area, and the competitions begin. And I realized real quick I did not have that skill set. You know, I threw the ball as far as I possibly could, and the next kid got up, and he was about 5 inches taller than me, and his arms were like this, and he threw the ball twice as far as I did, and I said, oh, this is not going to be a good day. Now, I will say, pull-ups were one of the things I did pretty well because I was little but fairly strong for my size. So I held my own in that area, but I think – around that time, I realized I need to stick with racing. That this is what's going to work for me.
It's really interesting that you said that your mother said that BMX racing was, I'm going to put words in her mouth, too dangerous.
No, she said that.
Because broken arms and things like that, concussions could have happened. And yet, within a blink of an eye, I mean, your father said, okay, fine. And then off he comes. He comes down the road with a flatbed truck and two midget racing cars on it. And she let you do that.
I know. He's a great salesman.
That's safer?
But it did have a roll cage and somewhat of a safety belt. So I don't know what he told her exactly, all the details, but it worked. And, you know, to his credit, I mean, I can tell you that over all those years of racing, the injuries that I sustained, and I had some bad wrecks along the way, were fairly minor. So I don't know if I'd have broke any bones riding a bicycle, but I've never broke a bone in a race car.
Did he, from what I gathered from reading as fast as I could this afternoon through your book, did he manufacture or craft a lot of these early vehicles for you?
I think what happened was when he was a kid, he knew someone in his neighborhood that raced quarter midgets or go-karts. And so I think he had a little bit of influence by that. He was a machinist by trade, mm-hmm. and a lot of his friends, as he was growing up in high school and beyond, always came to him to build things for their cars. And he did a little bit of that with some race cars at a local speedway, Vallejo Speedway. And so I think he had, like most people did in those times, had a passion for cars,
yeah.
But it also turned into a little bit of a passion for racing. And then that memory of when he was a kid, I think I was somewhat living out some of his dreams by becoming a race car driver.
I read that these cars could go as fast as 50 miles per hour. That's true?
I think if you put them on a straight, yeah, they would, but the tracks were very, very small, so they were you know, like 1/20th of a mile. So
right.
I don't know if at that time they got up to 50 miles per hour, but soon after I started, it was not long before at least 50 miles per hour.
And you were winning races, I think, by 5 and setting track records by 6. What would a track record be? How fast were you going?
Well, I can remember at one particular track we were in the low 5-second range. I remember the first time I started, I was probably running 9 seconds, 9.5 mm-hmm. seconds around that track. And by the end of, you know, that quarter midget career, I was in the 5-second range.
When you get to drive at such a young age, do you keep bugging your parents to drive the car? When did you first get behind the wheel of a regular car and actually get to drive it? Were you underage? Confess, you've had a couple of glasses of wine.
Yeah, I remember. I think I was racing go-karts with some friends of my family's that so they had a couple teenage sons that raced go-karts, and so at that time I started racing go-karts. I was probably 12, and I remember we took a trip not too far from Vallejo, but maybe 3 or 4 hours away, to race or practice go-karts. And I remember on the way home, I said, you know, can I drive? and I did. I mean, these, you know, I look back at these crazy times, but I'll never forget. It was a warm summer day. I'm 12, got my shirt off. I'm, you know, living in California. I got my sunglasses on. Thought I was just the coolest kid ever. And they go, you know, let's pull into this McDonald's. Let's get lunch. So I pull in. They go, oh, we'll just run in. So I'm just sitting in the driver's seat. And I'll never forget, a gentleman comes walking out of the McDonald's, walks straight over to me. He goes, son, how old are you? I know you're not old enough to drive this car. And I just looked at him and smiled and said, oh, I'm just sitting here in the driver's seat. Those guys are driving. So, yeah, I mean, listen, I love cars. I love driving. And I was very comfortable. If they would have let me, I would have drove.
Well, of course.
Long before I had a driver's license, I drove several hours down some of these roads with, you know, when we were racing, not with my parents, but with some others that I raced with. They'd say, oh, I'm tired. I got to get some, you know, some sleep. I was like, okay, you go to sleep. And I would be, you know, 14 years old and driving many, many miles. This is a bad, this is terrible. I can't believe the horrible influence I'm going to be on young kids listening to this show.
But see, you're Jeff Gordon. They can't do this because they're not Jeff Gordon. Because by 1979, you were 8 years old. I think you'd won 52 races, the Grand Nationals, 8 track records were set. Does winning things like that at such an early age, and then building on those wins as you go through the various different cars that you race, that really set you up, I would think, for NASCAR in a way that most people aren't going to be set up? It must have given you a great deal of confidence.
It did. And I think this exists in all forms of sports when you're competing at a young age, but certainly in racing. If you can have success at a young age, as long as it's against different competition in at different tracks, if you're going to one track and you're dominating, you know, I think it's a false sense of confidence. But if you go to different tracks, whether it's throughout the state, throughout the country, and you start seeing success and in doing things that show it on a consistent basis, builds a lot of confidence in your abilities, and that confidence helps you go to the next race and continue to step up your game, and then you I don't want to say feel invincible, but you feel like whatever the next step is, you might be a little bit hesitant, but you do have what it takes to move to the next level.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but when did you know, this is who I am, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, I think it was probably when I was around 16 and I was racing sprint cars and midgets around the Midwest and started winning against some very fierce competition. Mm. That's when I thought, you know, this, there might actually be more to this than just having fun.
Jeff Gordon is more than car racing, and we'll talk about some of the other things that he is into, and we'll also talk more about racing as well when we come back on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to our special edition of Charlotte Talks with Jeff Gordon in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte Talks support comes from WFAE members and Queen's Feast, Charlotte Restaurant Week, January 20th through 29th, with more than 130 metro area restaurants, offering 3-course prefix dinners, menus, and reservations at charlotterestaurantweek.com. And Catawba Science Center, the new In the Dark exhibit, opens Friday. Visitors can explore unseen worlds, encounter nocturnal animals, and see what happens in the dark. More info at catawbascience.org. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, An American in Paris. The Broadway musical version is in town. We'll talk to the leads about this hit treasure tomorrow. But first, we get the official Charlotte perspective on the Charlotte-Raleigh divide. That's when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Obama bids farewell. We'll weigh his message from Chicago and his years in the White House. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Jeff Gordon, and we are talking in front of a almost full house here at the auditorium at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Thank you all for being here. I know that every kid wants to grow up as fast as they possibly can, and I would think growing up, if you're in a race car, in a midget race car, and you're watching IndyCar and you're watching stock car racing on television, that you want to get into those cars. And you say in your book, the first time you cranked up the sprint car that you helped your dad build, and I quote here, this is NPR, "It scared the crap out of you."
That was me holding back on what I really wanted to say.
You compared it to giving up roller skates for a rocket. So how long did that feeling last?
Basically until I got to Florida a few months later and actually had to step on the gas pedal for the first time. And then I realized that that actually wasn't near as scary as pushing on the gas pedal. But yeah, I was 13 years old. And had pretty much dominated quarter midgets and did very well in go-karts, but we were looking for the next challenge. And at that time, unless you were 16 years old with a valid driver's license in California, there really wasn't any kind of racing or series. Today, there's a lot of options, but at that time, there wasn't. And so, you know, we talk about this influence motivation coming from my stepfather, and he believed in me so much, more than I ever believed in myself. And I remember we were having some discussions about, you know, where do we go from here? What's the next step? And I love sprint car racing. He loved sprint car racing. It was something, you know, I loved IndyCar racing as well. Those were a lot of my heroes, Rick Mears and A.J. Foyt and Al Unser. But we knew that that was not in anywhere close to where we were headed at that time. But what was the next step? Well, an Open Wheel magazine, which was a magazine I read all the time as a kid, showed an article about a kid named Sport Allen who was racing in Florida. He was 15 years old. He was not 16, and they allowed him to race. And immediately, and I don't remember if I showed the article to my stepdad or if he showed it to me, but immediately the light bulb went off, and he said, "We're doing this. We're going to build a sprint car. If he can do it at 15, you can do it at 13 and a half. I don't see any problem with that." And to me, it was a race car. I knew it was powerful, but I didn't know exactly what that meant. I'd never felt that type of power other than the cars I had driven. So here we go on this trek. Long story short, we build this race car. They had a machine shop where they had a manufacturing company where they built parts for those with disabilities where they could drive, like left foot gas pedals, hand controls, things like that. And so this machine shop, we built this car. We had a manufacturer in Indiana, Lee Osborne, who built the car, found an engine, put it together. Well, we knew that we couldn't race in California because my stepfather pursued every option of doing it in California. Nobody would let us. But in Florida, where this young kid was racing, we thought, well, we'll just go there. I have no idea what kind of phone calls were made, whether this was going to happen, but we had a race car, some spare parts, a trailer, and a truck. And here now we had a car, and we went up to Dixon, California, and found some old country road that we thought, hey, let's start this car up because we don't want to drive all the way to Florida and not, you know, run, of course. So the thing you have to understand about a sprint car, number one, is it weighs, you know, 1,400 pounds. at that time, it was probably 650 horsepower. And it's all direct drive. So there's no transmission or clutch or anything. You just put it in gear and it's just all throttle and all big, huge tires and just tons of power. It's like literally like a rocket ship on roller skates, like I mentioned. And so here I am on this narrow dirt road, gravel road, with ditches on either side, fences and farmland and cows and different things. And we fire, you know, this car goes sideways trying to get the rear tires to turn over. I finally flipped the switch and boom, it was like an explosion went off. This car leaped up in the air about 6 inches as the engine fired. Now, I couldn't get it out of gear fast enough, but I did it. I said, okay, we have it running. Now it's running. And my dad is extremely excited because the car is running. I'm sitting there scared to death because I'm thinking, wait a minute, I didn't even touch the gas pedal. I just was idling, and the car was and I thought, there is no way I'm ever going to be able to actually step on the gas pedal and race this car. And in 2 days, we're going to go drive 35 hours across the country to get to Florida and go race this car. So luckily we did that. The rest is history, really, if you think about what happened. You know, we went to Florida, had a few scary moments, no major incidences, but by about the third or fourth night that I was racing, I was up to competitive speed. And I look at that time in my life and what happened, and it's just almost like a miracle to me. That if I saw someone show up at the track with a 13-and-a-half-year-old kid getting ready to fire off a sprint car, I would stop them. I wouldn't allow it to happen. Huh. So, but I'm thankful it happened to me.
Well, yeah. Well, if it's like if going from midget cars to sprint cars is like going from a a roller skate to a rocket ship. What's it like to go to a NASCAR car, a stock car?
Well, other than the top speeds being much higher, you know, the weight to power ratio was far greater in the sprint car. Hmm. So, you know, really, and I do think that a stock car, especially if you talk about Bristol or some of the road courses, I think it's one of the most difficult cars I've ever driven because you have to be really careful not to overdrive. It's extremely, it doesn't stop very good, turns pretty good, power is amazing, but the tires are very small, narrow, and it's a very heavy car. So it doesn't do the things that you want a race car to do, which makes the driver play a much bigger role. But a sprint car, I think, is still this day, between that Formula One car and this car I've been driving down in Daytona preparing for the 24-hour race, probably three of the most awesome race cars I've ever driven.
Why did you choose stock cars over Indy cars?
I like to think it chose me. The only thing I could say is I grew up racing ovals. So all the quarter midgets that I racing that I did was all on oval tracks, dirt track, and pavement tracks. A lot of the go-kart racing I did was also on ovals. I did a little bit of road racing. But if you look at all the other series, they're more geared towards road racing and road racing drivers, and which is why a lot of Europeans or South Americans, people from outside the U.S., really excel at those series. But if you look at where Americans shine, they really excel on oval tracks. And so the first time I drove a stock car was in Rockingham, North Carolina, and I drove that car around the track. It was the first high-banked big oval I'd ever been on. It was a one-mile oval, and I just loved it. I thought, oh, wow, this is what I've been training to do my whole life, because it's an oval track and everybody's been trying to talk me into going to Indy cars and I have to learn how to become a road racer. And there are some ovals. In NASCAR, it was just a natural fit. And at the same time, it was the only opportunity that I had where I met somebody that said, I'd like to put you in my race car.
What do you love about it? What is it? Is it the power? Is it the speed? What, the fact that you win all the time? What is it?
You know, I don't know if, yeah, I don't want to say I'm a thrill seeker. I think all race car drivers have a little bit of that in them, some more than others. But I really think it's the competition. It's, you know, being able to control something that's somewhat out of control, but playing a role with the team, trying to make the car better, but also how you're going up against your competitors and trying to make a pass, trying to win a race, trying to do something to separate you from the competition and ultimately see the checkered flag. And when I was 5 years old and I saw that checkered flag wave and I was the first one to cross the line, and then, you know, a cute girl handed me a trophy, maybe that was a couple of years later. Those were all the motivation that I needed to want to be a race car driver.
You came to stock car racing at a time when the sport had just begun to change, and you were one of the people who helped change it. You were, and I don't mean this term pejoratively, but you were one of the pretty boys of racing in comparison to what had come before. So who were your heroes? Who did you look at who had come before you that you thought were something else and that you actually got to race against?
Well, that was a unique thing about me, and I think why when I first came to NASCAR, I wasn't really accepted, you know, the way that I am today or in the last several years, because I'm from California. I race sprint cars and midgets in Indiana. I didn't grow up racing late models or stock cars or taking the traditional path to NASCAR like so many before me did. Yeah, there was a few, Ricky Rudd, Ken Schrader, a few that maybe came from different areas. But for the most part, I mean, you look at the number of drivers that were from North Carolina or the Southeast when I came into the sport versus today, that's changed a lot. So at that time, that's a lot of what created this rivalry between Dale Earnhardt Sr. and myself,
right,
which was amazing for me, amazing for the sport. But, you know, when I looked at drivers, it was so late in the game. I mean, I remember it was probably 1989. I can remember watching the Daytona 500, watching a few NASCAR races. And you know, I was so busy racing midgets and sprint cars every single weekend that I really didn't watch a lot of TV, racing on TV. But IndyCars, I was more tuned into that. But I certainly knew all the big names. So when I first came into the sport, you know, I was in awe of Dale Earnhardt Sr., and really the guys I was racing against in the Xfinity Series, Mark Martin, Bill Elliott, Dale Jarrett, you know, those were the guys that I was competing with that were in the Cup Series, that were also coming over running Xfinity, that I wanted to be in the Cup Series. And so, you know, I wanted to emulate them. I wanted to compete against them. I wanted to learn from them. And I wanted to beat them, ultimately.
But you were young. You were clean cut. You were you were handsome. You were erudite.
No, did you see that mustache? And the,
well,
and
this, we all went through that period.
That's what I always say, but nobody seems to believe me.
But you know, you had a different look, and you had a different demeanor. You had a different vocabulary. You didn't come, as you said, from that background where you were doing the dirt tracks well the way they did them, and you didn't come from the South, and you certainly weren't a moonshiner.
No.
So did you feel? Did they make you feel not welcome? Did they resent the fact that you were this new creature, this new breed?
Well, when I say they, I'm mainly meaning the people in the grandstands. And I only base that off of driver introductions. You know, we had hundreds of thousands of people in the grandstands. I don't know what the people at home were thinking. I only know what the people that I, you know, was around. And at the beginning, I was just, you know, a young kid trying to make it in. And I think most of the competitors were, you know, fairly accepting. But you have to understand, any young driver at that time, it doesn't matter where he comes from or what he looked like, if you got a ride with one of the top teams, then you sort of didn't earn your way into it the way that they had to. And so they resented that. Then you take the California and the Midwest and the open wheel background, throw that into it, and then you start to get more resentment from some of the competitors. And that, you know, this is what I love about NASCAR. The fans, When they're loyal to their driver, they're loyal to them all the way. So if they hear a driver maybe say, yeah, you know, that Gordon kid, yeah, whatever, you know, he's with Hendrick, it's the best team out there. You know, if they didn't give me any respect, then the fans weren't either. And that really didn't show up until Earnhardt and I started battling with one another in 1995 for the championship.
How do you explain that fan loyalty? Because they're not only the fans in NASCAR not only attach themselves to a driver, they attach themselves to the sponsors of the driver and things like that. What's that all about?
I'm a fan of racing, but I'll be honest, NASCAR fans take it to a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. It's something that I guess, you know, I probably relate to better today because when I'm following a sport and I like somebody that's competing in that sport and I see a logo on and it could be consumer related or something else, if I see that item, then I'm going to look at it twice, or I'm going to maybe purchase it, or I'm going to check it out or learn more about it. And to me, that's what NASCAR fans are all about. I don't think it's just because they want to support the sponsor to keep the team going. It's that they have a connection, that they relate to that. And if you're representing that sponsor, then there must be something about it that you like, and they like you. To me, it's unique to any other sport, thankfully, it's worked out extremely well for our sponsors and for our series and for our industry.
If I have this right, the first time you were on the track at Charlotte Motor Speedway was in an open practice day, and that was thanks to Ray Evernham. Is this correct?
Yeah, that would have been end of 1990.
He got you into a car, and at the end of the day, for the first time on that track, in that borrowed car, you were second only to Davey Allison. But what impressed people was your ability to come out of the car and talk to the crew and break down what you felt the car was giving you or not giving you and what it needed to give you on that track in this weather at this time. Where did that come from? And when you get into a car, what are you looking for?
Well, I always tell people all the time, if you had driven a race car since you were 5 years old, and every weekend and every day that's all you thought about, and every weekend that's what you did, by the time you're 18 years old, you're going to be pretty darn good at it.
Or you're not going to be doing it.
Or you're not going to be doing it at all. And part of that process is how you communicate what the car. First, you have to understand what the car is doing. Part of winning races and part of being a race car driver is not just driving the car. It's driving the car to the limits and understanding what the limitations are. Am I the limitation? Do I need to push harder to drive the car harder? Is it capable of more? Or have I pushed it to the limits and now what I need more is this area of the car to ride this bump better, this part of the car to grip better, to turn the front better, to stick in the rear better. And so to me, that's a natural process that every race car driver goes through. But if you talk to a crew chief, they'll tell you, no, there's a few that have something special and know how to relate that to the team. If you're a driver, you say, no, there's certain crew chiefs that understand what I'm saying and know how to make it do it better.
Yeah, we only have a minute left, but you've been driving for 40 years, if I've done the math right, and that means you've been working for 40 years, and you're talking to a guy.
It never was a job, by the way.
Okay, well, I was going to say, because you're talking to a guy, if I have to get in the car right now and drive to Concord, it's too much driving. So in 20 seconds, when you're in the middle of a Daytona 500, do you think, is this ever going to end?
Well, now, I take back what I just said. I got paid to drive at Daytona and Talladega in the draft in three wide. The other races, that was for free. I can't explain it. It's the craziest, most chaotic experience you ever have in your life.
Jeff Gordon is our guest. When we come back, talk about some of the things outside racing that he's involved in. Stay with us at Charlotte Talk.
More of our special edition of Charlotte Talks with Jeff Gordon in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. Emerald ash borer is destroying ash trees in the Carolinas and is headed here. Ash tree owners can learn about EAB and prepare to protect and keep ash trees healthy. Tree guidance at heartwoodtree.com. And UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business, now offering hybrid MBA courses, meeting online and in person at the university's Center City campus. More at mba.uncc.edu. Coming up next on WFAE at 10 o'clock on Point, President Obama bids farewell. Tom Ashbrook and guests will weigh his message from Chicago and take a look back at the Obama years in the White House. That's On Point, coming up at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
The stage is set for a new administration, new appointments, fresh promises, and lots of questions.
There is more than a little curiosity about the various roles of members of the Trump family.
Public education could be in for some big changes this year.
Coal miners nationwide are waiting to see if Mr. Trump keeps election promises he made of new jobs through reopened mines.
NPR will be here to help you navigate all the changes. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jeff Gordon is our guest this hour. We're coming to you from the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And being the marquee talent for NASCAR for so many years has led to a lot of different things. I knew that you had done television. I knew that you'd done film. I did not know that you have your own IMDb page. If you follow movies and film, you know that actors have this page on the internet. You've done a lot of work.
I have. I mean, a lot of it started with sponsors and you know, a lot of the things that they were doing promotionally. But that turned into some other really cool opportunities.
And I worked with
Michael J. Fox on Spin City and Drew Carey on The Drew Carey Show. Of course, Saturday Night Live. And it's been an amazing life that I've led, that's for sure.
Well, you had done those two shows, Spin City and Drew Carey, and you'd also done, you filled in for Regis, I think, on Regis and Kelly several times.
It was easier to fill in for Regis than it was to fill in for Kelly. I can
because you couldn't get a word in edgewise.
could not. You have to jump in there.
But all during that, Saturday Night Live was pursuing you, and you kept ignoring them. And then I read that you were at some party, and this guy comes up to you and hands you a piece of an envelope, and you stick it in your pocket. And the party ends, and you pull it out of your pocket, and it's an invitation to host Saturday Night Live. And you think you can't do it. What made you decide that you could? Because ultimately you did.
Yeah, so NBC came in to NASCAR and started broadcasting, you know, the series, and you know, they wanted to really promote what they were doing with NASCAR. And so I was I think I was at the NASCAR banquet, and a gentleman mentioned it to me, and you know, I didn't really take it serious. I mean, he said it to me because I didn't think it was realistic. I thought, there's no way I can't do Saturday Night Live and make a, you know, ass out of myself, and you know, it would just be a huge failure. And so a year later, back at the NASCAR banquet, and this time he handed me an envelope where it was a written letter of an invitation. And I took that a little bit more serious. And at the time, I had been spending some time in New York with some friends, and I left the banquet and I went to dinner, and I pulled out the envelope and I opened it up, read it, and one of my friends said, "What's that?" And I handed it to him, and he's like, "Are you kidding me?" And then this is a New Yorker. This guy grew up, you know, born and raised in New York, and he just thought that was the most amazing, impressive thing he's ever seen in his life. And he said, "Well, I know you're going to do it." And I said, "No, I don't think so. They asked me one other time, and I just don't see it being a reality." And if it weren't for him, I wouldn't have done it. You know, he really pushed me and influenced me to do it. And after I did it, I thought, what an idiot I was. If only I had one opportunity, I would have missed out on so much in my life. But luckily, I had a second chance to do it.
That first time you did it, nervous at all before they say, "And now Jeff Gordon"?
In racing, you talk to drivers about getting pumped up to go do a qualifying lap. A qualifying lap, the car's at you know, maxed out aerodynamically, air pressures on the tires, power, and you have to fully commit. You have to drive in the corner and do things that naturally your mind and your body just are telling you that this is wrong to push the car to that level. And your heart starts beating before you take off to do that. That was nothing compared to the heartbeat that I had when they were announcing me to do Saturday Night Live. I was beyond nervous. It really was a thrill ride.
Yeah.
It was a thrill ride from the beginning to the end. I was out of my comfort zone. I had no clue what I was doing there, what I was capable of, and I was scared to death, but I was committed to doing it, and I was going to do the best job I could, and I had the absolute best time. And of course, now you can find it on YouTube and in different things, and me and my friends, you know, from time to time, we'll pull it up and just laugh, just cry, because, you know, it's just, I mean, the skits were pretty funny, but just seeing me do those things. Yeah. So if anybody knows me, they know I'm nothing like that in person. And so they knew it was a stretch.
One of the things that a celebrity allows a person to do is to make a difference. And not every celebrity does make a difference, but you are. Several years ago, and it wasn't that long ago in the scheme of things, you started the Jeff Gordon Children's Foundation. Why?
Well, you know, I was influenced by, and NASCAR is an amazing community. You know, before I got into NASCAR, you know, I can't say that I was surrounded or had been influenced around a lot of philanthropic work. But when I came into NASCAR, it was instantaneous. I heard about other drivers and the things they were doing. I remember specifically Jeff Bodine having Make-A-Wish kids, you know, attending races. And, you know, maybe by chance, they happened to come by me, and maybe I just saw them from a distance, or maybe I said hello. Somebody invited me to go to the Brenner's Children's Hospital up in Winston-Salem. And I was like, why? You know, why would you have me go? Sort of like Saturday Night Live. Right. You know, what good can I do to help kids, you know, that are going through a tough time or battling an illness? And then I went through the experience, and I went, wow, you know, I saw a change where somebody came in, changed up their routine, maybe had a car that had a race car on it that looked cool. You know, whether they knew me or didn't know me, I saw where it does make a difference. And so that influenced me, and then it wasn't long after that my crew chief, Ray Evernham, his son was diagnosed with leukemia. And then it hit close to home. And when it hit close to home and I started seeing these other things happening, I said, you know, I want to make a difference. I want to do something. I want to take whatever this is that I have. You know, I've never considered myself a celebrity, but certainly an influence on people and the potential to maybe do more with what was coming my way and contribute it towards. And I chose pediatric cancer.
Yeah, because you did get involved in leukemia because of Ray Evernham, and you gave money to start the Jeff Gordon Children's Hospital up at Concord at Northeast Medical Center. You created partnerships with other children's hospitals around the country. But your foundation focuses on pediatric cancer. Why?
Well, it's the number one cause of death of children in America. So that's the easy one. A lot of people don't realize that. You know, you hear about children battling with cancer, but you don't realize how many children are dying from cancer around the world and in the U.S. Then you also look at the amount of funding that comes from the government, you know, that goes back into pediatric cancer, and it's 4%. Of money raised for cancer. So obviously private funding is very, very big and influential. And being in racing, I know that research and development is a big part of what makes a difference in racing. And that's also a big difference in saving lives for children. So, you know, we started narrowing our focus down to pediatric cancer research and development, trying to find out better ways for not only curing cancer, but also for long-term, you know, effects of these treatments. You know, I'm very, very proud of the work that we've done, but at the same time, I'm very driven by it because I see how much more we need to do.
You point out that in the last 20 years, only 3 new drugs developed to treat children with cancer have been approved for use, and less than 4%, as you said, of the National Cancer Institute's budget goes to childhood cancer research. And we've done other programs on this topic, and what people don't realize is that most of the cancer drugs used for children are designed for adults,
right.
And what they do is reduce the dosage, and that changes the side effects a little bit, but they don't know the long-term side effects on tissue that is 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years old when you reach 50 or 60 if you survive the cancer. They just don't know. So these childhood drugs are important.
You're absolutely right. And I mean, look how technology is changing our everyday life. And to me, if we really apply technology of today and gear it towards children, obviously takes funding to do this, we are going to change these numbers in a huge way. And so that is our mission, you know, is to bring more attention to it, to find more funding, generate our own funding. And it's the successes and the failures that really drive us. A little girl named Leah Wasson, who was actually from Pittsboro, Indiana, where I lived, she went and received treatment. We thought that she was doing great, and that was in 2011. And, 3 years later, maybe four, she lost her life. And, when you've met a child and their family and you've seen what they've gone through, and the hope that they have, and then the struggles that they go through, those families are really what drive the work that we do, as well as those that, have the successes of, this worked for us, and our child is in remission and living a longer life because of the work that's been done so far. But it's the rare cases, cancers that come from, having it the first time that you didn't expect. It's all of the side effects that come along from the medications and treatments that, make you really want to have, you put every effort you possibly can into changing that.
And everything I've read about you, you're not just a face lending your name to this organization. You're actually in there. You're talking to doctors. The doctors comment on how interested you are about what they're doing and why what they're doing is important and why it works when it does and why it doesn't work when it doesn't. And the parents talk about how you know about them and their children. And the kids talk about how you help change their attitude. I mean, you're really in there doing this.
Well, I think you might be giving me a little bit too much credit, but I will say that, what we do at the Jeff Gordon Children's Foundation is do our research to make sure that if you donate $1 to us, we're going to make sure that dollar is going to the right area that's going to change people's lives, going to save lives, and make an impact. And the only way you can do that is understand, what the doctors are going through, what the families are going through, and what these researchers are going through, and what their challenges are, what's preventing them from making that big next step. And the way we do that is by getting involved and being there and asking those tough questions.
This started, what, in 1999? So very quickly after you were in NASCAR, you got a start of this. It wasn't long in the whole scheme of things. You have a global reach now. How many countries are you in?
Yeah, that's an amazing part of what we do because I was invited to be a part of the Clinton Global Initiative, their group and how they connect organizations globally to really make an impact in all different types of areas, but healthcare being one of them. Through that, we met somebody named Paul Farmer with PIH Partners in Health that set up hospitals in third world countries and, do amazing work where people that never saw somebody care about them, want to treat them, whether it be cancer or whether it be just, something very, very basic. And they can walk into those hospitals and they're in Haiti and they're in Rwanda and other parts of Africa, and they can get amazing treatment by some of the best physicians that they can possibly, ask for in that area and get treatment for free. And so we heard about a hospital in Butaro, Rwanda, that was being built. They didn't have anything related to cancer. And they said, would you be interested? We want to start this cancer center up there. Would you be interested? And we said, absolutely. Let us come and visit. And we went and visited, and we realized that, there are children that have tremendous pain and dealing with cancer, and they went somewhere, walked miles to go to a hospital or a medical facility, and they gave them Advil. And we're able to give them true medication to not only possibly heal them, but also take away their pain. And we accept everybody. And it's in a beautiful area. It's an amazing place, and they're doing incredible work, especially where they're located.
I don't want to run completely out of time before we talk about retirement. Although you're at the Speedway this morning and you're on an airplane tomorrow and you're here tonight, you're retired, or so I'm told.
I never used that word, but others did.
Did you ever have it when you decided that 2015 was going to be the last year? Did you have any second thoughts?
No, because I'd been thinking about it for about 4 years.
Why?
So, I think a couple reasons. There were a few years there where I was, you know, competing and it wasn't going as well as it had. I hadn't won a championship since 2001, and I saw some of the frustrations, you know, come in. Two younger kids, you know, so I started looking ahead to the future, as well as other opportunities. I've been so fortunate in my career to build this foundation, work with some amazing companies, have opportunities within NASCAR and beyond to do things beyond just driving. Yeah, I never really wanted to stop driving. I just was ready to stop driving full time in the Cup Series.
Although you're about to do 24 hours in Daytona, that's a long drive.
I know. You know what? I love that. I think that sounds like so much fun. I've been having a blast doing it. I got to drive in the rain the other day for, you know, one of the first times, and at night with headlights and a car that just stops and turns and does all these cool things. I got three teammates. And it, you know, that to me is fun because it's a one-off race. It's not 38 weeks of a grind in NASCAR. That's tough. That weighs on you when you've done it for 23 years.
You have a Chevy dealership. That I understand. You also have Jeff Gordon Cellars, which aims to produce small lot wines of distinctive quality and character. It sounds like a commercial.
And I apologize that our viewing audience did not get to sample some of that tonight.
Are you a wine connoisseur? Is that it?
I am. I mean, I'm from that area. Vallejo is very close to Napa Valley, so I knew all about vineyards and grapes when, you know, I was growing up. But as I got older, I started traveling around the world and experiencing you know, meals and wine and things like that. I really started enjoying it very much. And a friend of mine here in North Carolina said, who also enjoyed wine, said, yeah, you ought to have your own wine one day.
And lo and behold.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to come
back.
Since
2003 or 2004, we've been making wines.
You'll have to come back and talk about that, whether or not you bring the wine.
I will definitely bring it next.
Jeff Gordon, who is not retired, as his schedule will prove. Thank you for the hour.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Great time. Thank you.